Hello, this is another edition of Radio Warner. This is episode 39. Today is Friday, June 24th, 2016. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames. I am coming to you from Queens, New York, and I'm on the line with the Warner, Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan. John, are you in Phnom Penh still?
Yeah, still in Phnom Penh, still in one little room, really, because the little bugs I've been trying to ward off for 2 months finally caught up with me, and I've been sticking pretty close to the hotel room.
Yeah, so I don't know. I guess we should start this off by telling listeners that both of us have had kind of rough weeks this week. I had a colonoscopy, and John, you had food poisoning. So I basically had induced food poisoning. I had to drink a gasoline can size. I mean, it was just like sodium chloride or something. I don't know what the hell it was. The first few glasses, you're supposed to drink it every 15 minutes. It's like going to cleanse your colon out. And the first few glasses, you're kind of like, I think I can deal with this. I don't see what the big deal is because I had heard how awful it was. And after about an hour and a half of that, and I'd still barely made a dent in this giant plastic canister. I mean, it really, it sucked. You start to really understand how the body is almost designed to be tortured in all kinds of incredibly subtle and inventive ways. And I mean, this is just one I hadn't thought about. And I thought, God, this would be a great interrogation tool, in Guantanamo. And I'm sure they used it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I had an active little imagination from an early age. And it's really quite amazing if you want to spare a few seconds to look around the room and think how many torture implements there are in the room. A door is a torture implement if you want, a drawer, anything.
God, which reminds me, one of the things about Stepan Bandera, who we'll be talking about a little bit today, and I hope I'm up to the task, because on top of the colonoscopy and the induced vomiting and everything else this week, my little infant boy had a bad night last night. I think his molars are coming in. So that meant, I mean, daddy had a bad night too, didn't sleep much. But in any event, Stepan Bandera, who is, of course, the Fuhrer, the leader of the Ukrainian nationalist fascist movement between the two wars and afterwards, and is kind of the spiritual guiding light of Ukrainian, especially Western Ukrainian nationalism to this day. In any event, when he was young, when he was already an adolescent, he used to practice. He kind of dreamed of being a sort of a radical revolutionary terrorist from a very young age, which is not uncommon, as we've talked about in this show. And he grew up, at a time of he was born in 1909, so it was a very violent era. In any event, he used to torture himself to prepare for when the Polish government or the Polish leader, interrogators would interrogate him. So he'd stick like sharp pins underneath his fingernails to see how much he could, how much pain he could withstand. And when he was in college in the university in Lvov, he would take an oil lamp and burn his fingers on it and then run to the door and smash it between the door and the door frame and over and scream, I won't give in, I won't give in. His other classmates talked about it. And he's like this little 5 foot.
Actually practicing his lines.
Yes.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember being a depressed adolescent and burning myself. But what I remember when I tried to think, hey, I might stand up to torture is, no, it's very different when you torture yourself and when somebody you really fear is torturing you. I mean, you find really interesting things. Like it's much more painful to burn yourself with a match or a series of matches than with a lighter, because lighter burns hot. And third-degree burns don't actually hurt. So there's all kinds of little complications here, but I'm not sure you can really practice for torture by doing it to yourself. I mean, torturing yourself is kind of a complex pastime, and having it done to you very suddenly by somebody you don't know who obviously hates your guts is going to be a little different.
Which raises the question, maybe he just liked it. He also would beat himself with a belt. He'd whip his back and say, Bandera, tell us the information. He said, no, I won't admit it, while whipping himself in his dorm room.
Wow.
Yeah. It's kind of, so he's like a, you know, we'll get to him in a little bit. 5'3", rat-faced, very kind of rat-faced teetotaler. Never smoked, never drank. Really grim, serious. Basically, very much like what would have been a, his father was a Greek Catholic priest. What would have been right. a priest's or a preacher's son in a different time. He just happened to come of age in this period when fascism suddenly kind of replaced or went along with religion.
Well, I was actually going to mention, if I wasn't being too ethnocentric, that all sounded really Catholic to me. And then it occurred to me, well, it could sound Shia too, but no, that sounds pretty Catholic. I mean, there's all kinds of Irish Catholic martyrs who are, Matt Talbot, for example, who's parodied on Father Ted as such a saint that he was allergic to cats and he kept a kitten with him at all times. So, and they would sniff it whenever he had a sinful thought.
That's pretty funny. Do you know the difference, by the way? I didn't get into this. There was just too much to research. But what the difference between Greek Catholicism and the Roman Catholicism, the Polish, of course, are Roman Catholics. I mean, the difference I can imagine is just that this is how the Ukrainians, you know, it's a typical sectarian, ethnic sectarianism. So this is sort of how the Ukrainians under Polish rule separated themselves from the Polish, right, rulers.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was wondering about that, and I tried looking it up, and I don't have an easy answer. In the first place, the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, if you say Greek, you're going to go Orthodox, and if you say Catholic, you're going to go Roman. And no, I don't get that. It's like the orange Catholic Bible that they mentioned in Dune.
Yeah, it's very contrarian. Doesn't make sense. Yeah.
I mean, this is, as we'll talk about later, it's a sort of a very grim, doomed part of the world. I was reading about Galicia. I mean, there are two Galicias, one in Spain that everybody likes and the other one in north of the Carpathians that nobody ever liked. And the ethnic snobbery there extended even not to Jews, but among Jews. Hmm. Like, there was a joke among German Jews who were called Yekka, I think, which was, why did God speak to the Jews in Hebrew? Because if he'd spoken Yiddish, everybody would have thought he was a Galicianer.
But it's funnier in the original German.
Yeah, it's funnier in the original, and if there's a Galicianer in the room who has to laugh nervously.
Yeah, no, well, that was an issue also kind of at that time when, you know, in the 1920s, America and the American elites, actually a lot of military intelligence, blue bloods, naval intelligence, blue bloods, were fixated on this sort of Nordic, you know, the Nordic race and Nordic superiority. And that's when they passed all these immigration laws, massively restricting immigration in the 20s, early mid-20s, under Coolidge. And a lot of that was really aimed at East European Jews who were thought to be, it was kind of like, you know, the Charles Murray, Andrew Sullivan days. I mean, they were thought to be genetically inferior to like German Jews. They were thought to be, you know, worse genetic material. They were thought to be dumber. They had all kinds of phrenological ideas on these Slavic and East European Jews. And so, yeah, they were barred. And I think a lot of the German Jews that were already here, you know, didn't completely disagree. They weren't as rabid about it, but they looked down on them as well. It's true.
No, I you see that in any ethnic group that's had a difficult time and wants to, well, some parts of which want to align themselves with whoever's dominating. I mean, and in Vienna, there was a very interesting reactionary mayor, and you know, in the early 20th century, named Karl Luger, he's the dude who said one of the most trademark phrases of the 20th century in all its grimness. He was anti-Semitic as a politician, and his more fanatical anti-Semitic friends would say, but, you know, your mistress is Jewish, all your friends are Jewish. And he would glare back at them and say, I decide who is a Jew.
Yeah. So the bottom line here is Europeans are pretty crazy, which segues into Brexit vote last night, which we didn't really prepare for. So all we can kind of do is, you know, make
nobody prepared for it. Everybody prepared for telling us that. I seriously read an article from CNN 2 days ago that said Brexit fears dwindle as a vote nears or something like that. It was they all said that Britain would vote to stay in the EU. And it reminded me very much of that Morrissey line, which frankly is all you need to know about British elections and why you shouldn't believe the polls, which is we won't vote Conservative because we never have. Everyone lies. And they lied.
That's that kind of fascisty song where he goes, London is dead, London is dead. Is that the one? Yeah. Okay,
it's Glamorous Glue. Yeah, I think he said that.
Yeah. Well, and I seem to remember a lot of, there were several elections where the Tories were supposed to have lost. It was for sure. All the polls showed Labour winning. And then the last one even, it happened that way. It seems to happen a lot in my lifetime.
It seemed to take up half my life that way, and they did it again. I mean, if only I had money that I could have invested in. Wait, what do you do if you think the pound is going to go down? You buy a bunch of dollars and then sell them for pounds. I don't know, but at any rate, it was fairly clear that they were going to get it wrong again. In fact, there was another article in some British newspaper saying, "What will we do if the pollsters are wrong again?" And it was actually saying, this time we'll really ostracize those phonies. And it was like listening to some neocon pundit say, well, okay, this time we won't be wrong, or there'll be penalties. Mm. Of course there won't be penalties. Yeah. They'll still get grist for the mill, and they'll churn out a million articles about the polls. Polls will all be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no one pays anymore either. Yeah. So what do you chalk it up to, the Brexit vote? I mean, you know, there's people are trying to make sense of it. It's either xenophobia or it's a natural working class reaction to the cold neoliberal technocratic nature of the European Union. Something tells me a lot of them weren't thinking about it in those politicized manners that they gut vote. But you tell me. But it is hard to deny. And anybody who denies this, most people who would deny this are liars, that there is a certain pleasure watching the British elite establishment losing their shit on television. It's the one fun thing about Trump is watching people lose their shit. You don't want Trump to happen, but God, it is funny watching.
Yeah. And by the way, his comment, I don't know if you saw it, was, the Brexit, it's a great thing. So they got that going for them. And I watched several hours of BBC today, trying to get my intestines to settle down. And it was astounding. I mean, the Conservatives are split between the cautious establishment Conservatives who are trying to pretend that nothing has happened and the really nasty debate champion types who are just openly gloating over having won this, and nobody knows what to make of it at all, and nobody would really mention any of what seemed to be the issues here. Like there was a strange report from a correspondent in Poland saying people here seem really hurt. They're asking, why did you do this to us? And the background for that is there are a million Poles in Britain. I don't know why they're hated, but the usual reason would be they work cheap, they don't speak your native slang perfectly, and you expect that everyone will. You're afraid that if one group of refugees can get in and you think of the Poles as refugees, well, Europe is experiencing a big population transfer from southeast to northwest, and Maybe they want to retreat back to the good old English Channel, which used to serve as a nice kind of wall.
Yeah, do we know if the Brits were specifically angry about the Polish community there? I mean, I seem to remember when I was in Britain, actually, you know, when I had to flee Russia, when they shut down the paper, and then Robert Schlegel was on the radio screaming about me. So this was 8 years ago now, Jesus. I went straight to, I mean, I just went to the airport, bought a ticket there, and went to London. There was an old friend from Berkeley who was living there, said I could stay with him while I figured out what to do. And I went there, and that was when I first started really hearing about this, you know, Polish migrant worker problem, as they saw it there. And it was a very big deal, and people talked about it a lot. But was this, how much of the, were they talking about it today? Was it more a talk in Poland where they were kind of hurt and upset?
Only the Polish correspondent seemed to mention it at all. Everyone else was talking about this in terms as false as you'd hear in the equivalent panel discussion in the U.S. Nobody mentioned anything about ethnicity or the long tradition of conquest-minded island nations of not liking to have the mainland people come onto their shores. But those are obvious factors here. And I mean, I'll tell you, I was looking for a job a couple of years ago, a doom job in Saudi Arabia that never materialized. I think even if I'd gotten it, they just would have Googled me, found some Warner thing and fired me. But I didn't get it. And I had to wait several weeks in England to find out if I would get it. I spent a few horrendously expensive nights at the cheapest place I could find in London, and then went up to stay with a friend at a former council estate in near Wigan, let's say, which is near Manchester. We actually visited Mark E. Smith's old stomping grounds, in fact. Mm. The contrast between the two places is just astonishing. Not just because in London you see faces from all over the world, but because in this northern estate where I was visiting, my friend, who's half Latin American, used to get racially abused when he was growing up. He looks what I suppose in the U.S. would be called Mediterranean. And I didn't even, you know, I understand racial abuse exists, God knows, but I didn't even get it because he would have merged in the American notion of somewhat of Mediterranean blood. But that was not good enough on that council estate when he was growing up. Everybody there was white. He didn't look white, and that was a problem. And the two Britons are really, really clear when you spend some time in a place like that. There are non-white people in this northern estate, but they're, I think, more established minorities, like South Asian people who run a lot of the businesses in the area. But I suppose there's been time for the British population and the South Asian immigrants to integrate to a certain degree. But there have been these other waves of recent immigration, like Polish people. And although I'm sure there's a million rationalizations for why they're such a nuisance, it usually comes down to they work for less than you do. And that annoys you reasonably enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that raises another question. I mean, if the British are so completely xenophobic, I mean, this isn't obviously about the bulk of their non-native British, I don't know what the hell you call them, population, which is people from their empire. I mean, I imagine they make up the bulk of non-native English blood, whatever, people, would be people from South Asia and other parts of their empire. But the Brexit vote isn't about them, obviously.
No, and maybe there's an appeal to the old empire as opposed to Europe. Mm-hmm. I mean,
That's what I was thinking.
I mean, I saw this in New Zealand. I used to teach creative writing in New Zealand, and every semester you could be sure somebody would turn in an account of going through the long non-EU passport line at Heathrow or Gatwick and thinking about, thinking bitterly about your grandfather's grandfather who died at Gallipoli. There's a lot of anger in a lot of parts of the empire about the way Britain, when the time was right to pivot, pivoted from its marine empire to the continent. And now that the continent is looking a little frayed and bankrupt, I'm sure a lot of people would like to pivot back to that those seagoing associations with other English-speaking places.
Mm-hmm. How much of this is about, as I guess a few historians out there have said, is about finally throwing off the yoke of the Norman conquest?
did somebody
I think he was joking. Kind of funny, I found it actually, a column by an historian, a right-wing historian, I guess, named Tim Stanley, in the Telegraph. And the headline was, "Brexit isn't about nostalgia, it's about ambition. Trust me, I'm a historian." Which is, he was being kind of ironic. He's got this very punchable face. But he writes that there was no historical case for leaving the EU. There was no historical case for staying in. That's because this isn't an existential matter. It's a practical decision. Do you think your country is better off in or out? I think the latter, so I'm voting for Brexit. Well, I mean, that's already bullshit as well. It's a practical. Do you think these guys who voted, they made this like practical decision? I think he's talking to a particular class when he's talking here.
Yeah, I mean, the EU has been really good for some parts of Europe that were always very poor and marginal, like literally marginal, like places on the edge, Ireland, for example. The EU is very good for Ireland, and including Northern Ireland, and they voted to stay in, just like Scotland did. But I know a lot of British people feel, because I've heard them tell me this all over the world, because British expats tend to be uninhibited about telling you these things, that they're sick of paying for the poor part of Europe to get a little better off, and they think they'd be better off on their own, or maybe if it could just be them in Germany, but that's not feasible, so they have to detach.
Yeah, and to the point about the empire versus Europe, this is what this guy writes at the end. It's kind of interesting. He goes after historians that have been trying to argue that Britain is already very Europeanized and EU-ized, and it's crazy to, it doesn't make any historical sense to pull out. And he's kind of arguing with Simon Schama. So what he says here is, for Schama is right, I am a European by historical chance. But my great-grandfather also worked for an Indian nobleman, and my mother was raised in the Caribbean. When I was at university, my first specialism was Kenyan history. Then I switched to the study of the USA, a country I regard as my second home. I am not a little Englander, but I'm also not a little European. We are shaped by history, but need not be imprisoned by it, blah, 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 blah. So
he's more like an English empirer.
Exactly. It's funny. He's claiming he's not. He says he's trying to claim that it's all very practical, but it sounds to me like an empire completely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't have to learn so many languages either. I mean, I swear that's a big part of the English only thing in the U.S. is just the horror of having to learn another language, even if pretty easy, reasonable language like Spanish. It's just enrages Anglophones who are used to making people speak their language.
So they're over the Norman syndrome by this point, I think.
Yeah, well, some people are. Some people are still excited about that. I mean, I know someone who thinks of the Battle of Hastings as the great tragedy of human history. I don't get it myself.
I guess you need a tragedy to go around and wave in everyone's face of it, you know, when it's all your own. All right. So, so that happened, and I mean, I doubt the, you know, the sky is not going to fall. It's bad for some businesses, probably. It does mean a lot of new contracts. It does mean some uncertainty, you know, in debt issuance instruments and whatever. Right. I mean, so it creates problems, I think, for the kind of multinationals and finance industry especially. And but I'm sure they'll sort it out. They always do.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah. Nobody is going to do anything that's going to really cost them money. It might be a problem if you bluffed the EU and it was full of aggressive, angry states that would take you at your word, call your bluff. I don't think that's going to happen. They seem like very docile countries at the moment, so you can probably insult them like this and get away with it. I mean, what the Tory press has been doing, and you see it every time you're there, is something you see the right-wing press do in the U.S. as well, which is like bring up some idiotic government regulation or idiotic-sounding government regulation as if it were a synecdoche of the whole institution, yes, and say, see, we need to get rid of this.
Yeah, exactly. They did a study on, you know, how mice react to a blonde hair dye and, you know, wasted 35,000 pounds on that. Is this what we want to be part of? Yeah.
Yeah. And it usually turns out they did that rather than just, you know, paying poor people to get their hair pierced.
Exactly. All right. So shall we move on from here to, I mean, so the one of the subjects, or maybe the main subject of today, was because we're coming up to the 75th anniversary. We are at the 75th anniversary of Operation Barbarossa. And then shortly after that, the Ukrainian nationalist, fascist nationalist, the OUN, the Banderites, their brief takeover of parts of Eastern Galicia, which we were just talking about. So Eastern Galicia was kind of the heartlands where Lvov is, the heartland of Ukrainian nationalism in Volhynia, or whatever the hell it's another region there. So I think June 30th, 1941 was when the Ukrainian battalions first moved into Lvov, and then they had what they called their national awakening or something over the next few days, which really just meant killing thousands and thousands of Jews, and brutally, you know, in all kinds of really horrible ways. And that's relevant today because obviously there's a war there in Ukraine now, in the eastern part of the country, between pro-Russians and Ukrainian nationalists. And a lot of the leading fighters and leading Ukrainian nationalists directly take their inspiration openly from the Bandera and the OUN. They've turned them into heroes. They now say the same slogans. They've, you know, renaming streets after these guys. And we don't know much about who they are. And if you mention now historical facts about them, you're branded a Kremlin stooge, a Putin stooge. You know, you can't even really talk about it. And it's kind of annoying. But I figure it's been a few years now since that war started, and some of the tempers have calmed down a little bit, and so I think you can.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have to. Yeah. At some point, we have to take apart this good war narrative, and I never understood it to begin with. Really, I mean, the whole monstrous war at the beginning of the 1940s was an abomination, and in the case of Ukraine and countries like Latvia, you're dealing with a really murky and unpleasant history, which involves real oppression by Soviet and pre-Soviet Russian occupiers, and also involves real bigotry and xenophobia leading to massacre on a regular basis. And there's just no way you can try to make simple moral sense out of this. I mean, one thing I found useful is a book that was written by Donnie Gluckstein, who is a bit of a Trotskyite. So, you know, he has to say the bad, evil USSR and the bad, evil British Empire were fighting, and the good, honest, common people occasionally were trying to rise up, and they didn't realize they were going to be crushed between them. it's not that moral or that simple, but he does do a good job of showing why none of this war was good in any way. His book is called A People's History of the Second World War. And if you read it, knowing he's a Trotskyite, it's not a bad read.
Yeah, well, and I mean, what's useful about these things is you just have to know how to read all of these books and these histories. You know, they're all going to have an angle on it. But if you come at it from a kind of Trotskyite point of view, you're going to get a lot of angles that other people would miss or deliberately omit are important. So, yeah. But for me, one of the reasons also why I wanted to talk about this in War Nerd was because I wanted to know not just sort of who and why, you know, point out that Bandera and the OUN and the fascists and the Nazi collaborators are bad. I mean, that's obvious once you establish that they did collaborate and did kill a lot of Jews, and especially Poles. I want to know why we have found them so useful and why we kept their flame alive. And because, you know, it's one of these things, like when you get into college and you first find out that, well, let's say in this instance, that America backed Nazi collaborators, then you have this freak out, oh my God, that just proves America is Nazi Germany, you know, and that's silly. What it is they're useful for us. And so they're protected, because one of the other things that always weirded me out about this, I was not very positively predisposed towards Russia, obviously, after they shut down my paper and I was out here. But then, you know, as soon as you get out here, you just see things that, I mean, I'm not crazy about us trying to, you know, heat up a low intensity war with Russia again. And it seems to be some old obsession. And when Yushchenko was one of the two leaders of the Orange Revolution in 2004. And he was considered like this liberal hero. And I remember Jake Rudnitsky, who was ex-OG, went out there for the Orange Revolution, was very inspired. You know, it was, I know what it's like in those revolutions, these brief periods where you feel like you have some power, like you can change things. And they always get co-opted by the most organized people, which then were neoliberals. Now in Ukraine are more neoliberals plus ultra-nationalists. But in any event, Yushchenko went bad over time. He was the guy that was poisoned with the dioxin and his face got all pockmarked and everything.
Right.
And he went very bad over time, very corrupt. He wound up helping put in prison Yulia Tymoshenko, who led the Orange Revolution with him. He joined up with Yanukovych, the bad guy, the pro-Putin guy. And just before he left a bomb. And I wrote about this for The Nation. And the bomb was, he officially, I mean, literally the month that he left office, he ran for president in 2000, and I think it was 10, and got, I think he didn't make it into the second round. He got only like 2 or 3% of the vote. He was so despised. So he left a little bomb. He officially rehabilitated Stepan Bandera, who I'd vaguely heard of, and put statues up. And this was immediately denounced by the EU, and he revived this old Ukrainian far right historical revisionist movement to equate the famine as a crime with the Holocaust. And this is considered it's called double genocide. It's considered a form of Holocaust denialism, especially because it's usually promoted by countries that are rooted in collaborationist regimes, or countries where there was a powerful kind of nationalism that collaborated with the Nazis. So in any event, he did this, and the EU kind of forced them to rescind it. And when I was working on the article, I was trying to get comments from Jewish groups and Holocaust studies groups on why it's bad. And, you know, none of them would really comment on it. They didn't really want to talk about it publicly. So I finally found this guy, Dovid Katz. Katz is his name. He's a Yiddish historian. He lives in Vilnius in Lithuania. He's like a one-man, relentless machine to just make sure that Eastern European and, really, Ukrainian and Baltic peoples, like the Holocaust there and how it went about and how the locals went about you know, perpetrating the Holocaust, that it's not forgotten. And he told me, he said, you have no idea. Like, no one wants to talk about it in the Jewish community. I mean, in Israel, they'll talk about it a little bit. But it's discouraged by American power. American power doesn't want to talk about. So even the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. doesn't really want to talk about Ukrainian collaboration and Ukrainian nationalist collaboration because the Americans don't want to hear about it. And yeah. So they kind of stick with the parts of the Holocaust that jive, that, you know, sync with what are in the interest of the American empire, basically. And that was kind of shocking to me. I mean, you know, this all-powerful Jewish lobby has to basically censor itself on where most of the Holocaust went down, or at least a big part of it is Poland and Ukraine. You can talk about a part in Poland, but not really Ukraine.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I've been trying to read up on this myself, and I've seen serious denials that Ukrainian nationalism had an anti-Semitic tinge, which is absurd.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's part of the way the world went through a sort of psychotic break between 1939 and 1945, and or at least the European part of the world did a complete memory wipe and changed really radically, because the kind of racial hatred you're describing was absolutely the norm, and it was a positive norm for a lot of people. I mean, when you start looking into the hatreds in that part of the world, you get lost. I mentioned a nasty little rhyme I remember from Limonov's memoir about growing up in Kharkov, and it's a Ukrainian patriotic rhyme. Into Muscovite, Polak, and Jew, take your knife and slash it through, or something like that. And I think the Russian, the Ukrainian word there is Moskal, which is apparently the Ukrainian insult for Russian, like Khohol is Russian for Ukrainian. Moskal. So it's not just, it's not just the Jews that are hated. It's anybody who isn't identified with your tribe and your sect, because they tend to be coextensive. And it gets incredibly complicated there. Pilsudski was expelling Ukrainians from Poland. Bandera's people were massacring Poles in Galicia and the areas to the east of that. It's hard to see, above all, how anybody can make a moral world out of this. But the Cold War did. And in that moral world, the Russians themselves, the Soviets, whatever they called themselves, they were going to be the bad guys. And whoever was fighting them, they were going to get goodened up.
Yeah. And then there are other reasons why it was useful. Why empowering the extreme right and keeping their sort of flame alive in the U.S., Canada, and Britain, why it was very useful in the Cold War. And this kind of segues into counterinsurgency strategies of the Cold War.
Yeah.
And so I think I'd rather now, like, you and I can talk about a few different case examples, and then once we've talked about that, then we'll go back to the Ukrainian nationalists again, and then forward a little bit to today.
Yeah, I think that's good, because there's a pattern here, but it's not an easy one to describe, especially when the history we're talking about has been so simplistically moralized for so long that it's really hard to unravel all that. But let's...
Not just moralized, but also obfuscated in a major way.
Yes.
The idea that you could not... I mean, it's just... It's bizarre. Like, we had in this country the... Mykola Lebed, who was the head of the OUN's, he was the head of the Nazi puppet government in Lvov's police, of the head of their police when they rounded up Jews and slaughtered them. And he was a terrorist. I mean, he was, even the CIA files initially said the guy's a known sadist and a murderer. and a liar. But he, because he was the head of the police, and then when he went underground, when Hitler initially then said, okay, you guys are not going to be the Ustasha because I actually want to turn all of you into slaves, so you're going to be demoted one level down. So the OUN went into kind of semi-official underground, semi-underground status. Mykola Lebed then became the head of the kind of the intelligence unit called the Security Bureau, underground until 44, when the Nazis rehabilitated them completely again and made them official allies again. And then he left to the West and he said, hey, you're going to be fighting a Cold War with Russia. I know more about the Russians and what's going on in Ukraine than anybody. Save me. So yep. So the CIA worked with lawmakers to pass a law. It was called like the 100 Families Law or something like this in 1948-49, where the CIA was allowed to bring in 100 people a year and their families without any questions asked, no matter what crimes they'd committed anywhere. Wow. And Lebed was one of the first ones brought in, and he was given a different name, and everybody knew who he was. Within 5 years, he's like in Newsweek magazine, you know, with his face, giving lectures at Yale about, you know, oppression in Ukraine. This guy is a mass murderer.
And in fact, he was the excuse. I mean, he is the excuse that Bandera's fans use when they try to absolve him of all these massacres of Jews. They say, no. He was, what is it? He was incarcerated by the Germans at the time, and it was that Lebed guy who was doing all this.
I know. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, fortunately, thanks to especially this historian, there's very little written about Bandera, and that's one really clever way of covering something up, is having almost no history on a important figure.
Look, yeah. after trying to study the empire, where it gets really hard, I mean, I'm starting to think that's the best strategy of all, and it's the one that's worked for a lot of institutions for a long time. Just don't mention it. If anybody else mentions it, just don't answer, and control as much of the media as you can. That's really the best way to do it.
Yeah, so this a very timely history, very big, thick, heavily footnoted, put out the English version through Columbia University. It's called Stepan Bandera, The Life and Afterlife of a Ukrainian Nationalist, Fascism, Genocide, and Cult. And it's by Grzegorz Rosolinski-Liebe. And he's at the Free University of Berlin. And this is put out again by, and it's very good. And what he's gone through all the files and done several years of research and published in all kinds of journals. And, you know, and he writes even a lot about the obfuscation of history. But it's very clear from Bandera's writings. I mean, he was the Pravodnik, which means basically the Führer of this group. And he headed up congresses, like their congress in Nazi-held Krakow in 1941, where they specifically called for the extermination, liquidation of Jews, of Poles, and of Muscovy Russians, and establishing a dictatorship of a cleansed and purified Ukrainian state. But in any event, so let's go to some. I don't know which one, where you want to start. The one thing I wanted to maybe start off with, though, is America decided it needed to be bad and evil and crazy when it took over, you know, the empire right after World War II. And here's this quote by George Kennan. We all know him as this kind of fussy Tweety, you know, the father of containment theory. In any event, here's this quote from 1948. It's from a top secret review of current trends U.S. foreign policy. This is the architect of the Cold War, and here's Kennan. He says, we have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of the population. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming. We should dispense with the aspiration to be, quote, liked, unquote, or to be regarded as the repository of a high-minded international altruism. I think this is top secret. That means these guys are talking to each other and basically saying, this is kind of how, you know, what we call fascists talked as well.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, well, that's imperial. That's about as imperial as I've ever heard an American be in the, well, in after 1945, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so two, you know, there are a lot of cases we could look at here, and I think, and you want to look at the British counterinsurgency in Malay. So, because we faced a new kind of, the British and the Americans and the West faced a new kind of insurgency, which was presumably different from others, which was communist-inspired. And right. So some of the tactics and strategies changed. But, of course, I think yes. One thing that's forgotten, as you pointed out before the show, we talked about this a little, some of the tactics were very much the same as well. I mean, America has been an expanding empire since its founding. I mean,
yeah,
taking over Indian lands and exterminating Indians.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah. I wrote an article long ago saying, wherever you live, who owned that land 300 years ago? It's always worth thinking about that wherever you are. And in fact, okay, I'm in Phnom Penh. Who owned this place 300 years ago? The Khmer Empire had already fallen. Mm. I guess the Thai Ayutthaya was going. But even here, I really don't know who owned this place 300 years ago. I mean, the changes come really fast, but you don't usually get too many of them in a human lifetime. Like if you went through the last big change in Phnom Penh, the Khmer Rouge, that was likely to be the only big historical change you would see because you wouldn't live to see another. And the ones who don't live don't write books, obviously. So, yeah, there's a lot more brutality and mobility to all this than we think or would like to think. So, yeah, it's worth remembering this has always happened with us. We speak a conqueror's language. We have a lot of experience in conquest. Sometimes we've shared it with the British Empire. There was a point during the Second Opium War in which an American gunship that had been ordered to stand by while the British fleet blasted a Chinese base that was trying to defend its coastline from a bunch of drug dealers, jumped into the fight saying, "Blood is thicker than water," meaning, you know, this was, as you say, the time they were still thinking of the northern peoples as one thing, especially the English-speaking northern peoples. They were cream of the crop as far as they were concerned. So, this was a time of tremendous solidarity between the United States and Britain. It was sort of understood Britain might not have the money, especially the money, or the manpower to run the whole empire, but we would be their agent for them until they could get themselves back on their feet and take it back. And some places they would take back for themselves, like what was then Malaya, the Malayan Peninsula, now mostly the country of Malaysia. And, you know, as I get old, I find it hard even myself to believe that there was a time when people were really frightened of communism and communist expansion. But there was. And they identified that with all kinds of things that don't seem to have much to do with it, like Russia and China. China's still a communist country, but, you know, don't act like it much. And Russia has stopped even pretending to be. But in the mid-20th century, communism was thought to be the future, unless you put a lot of effort into stopping it. It would just naturally win. And in Malaya, as it was then, there was a Malaysian Communist Party with a Malayan National Liberation Army, MNLA. And up to 1945, the year of the big memory wipe, up to 1945, the British forces that survived the fall of Singapore were helping these communist guerrillas to fight the Japanese. They were best friends. Mm. And then they realized, okay, the Japanese are gone. It's going to take them 20 years just to get back on their feet. The Germans are gone. It's going to take them the same amount of time to get anywhere. It's a new game. And we have to stop this supposedly powerful thing, communism, with its incredibly insidious appeal. And behind this, you can always hear, and I grew up with this, so I know, you can always hear, ooh, it's going to win. It's going to win. There's something about it. It's the future.
Yeah.
People really believed in the future in them days. It's, the world has cycled back lately. But at that time, they thought it would keep cycling forward. And communism was associated with that.
Yeah. Because it was popular with the top university intellectuals.
Yeah.
Them, right?
Yeah.
And so it felt, and that was actually one of its big appeals. That's what I think, I mean, we've talked about this before, I think it's what inspired people to die, was the absolute firm conviction that it was the future.
Yep, yep. Yeah, what they didn't notice is that those university lecturers weren't having many kids, and consequently they, you know, and that also communism was a very new ideology. It hadn't had much time to ferment among people, but nobody knew any of that. Nobody ever knew when I was a kid that the Soviet Union would fall. Nobody except Andrei Amalric, as I said before. So the British, who are weak at the end of the war, find themselves dealing with this communist rebellion in the jungles, as they were then. They've all been sold off for lumber. But back then, they were jungles of the Malayan Peninsula. And officers like Freddie Chapman had been serving with these guerrillas up to 1945. I read his book, The Jungle is Neutral, about working with Chinese communist guerrillas. He found them very likable people. But now they're enemies.
This happens a lot. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I noticed this in one after another insurgency. I mean, the communists fought the fascist occupiers better than anyone in most places, like Yugoslavia, like Greece,
yep.
You know, in Vietnam, we were allied with Ho Chi Minh, and they're always surprised when we turn on them. Every case, it's the Huck uprising in the Philippines, as they actually very gladly and eagerly handed over. We said, "We'll let you be a legal party." I'll get to this later. Just hand us the list of everybody in the Hook movement, and so we gave it to them. And then all of a sudden, they were just getting picked off every day after that.
Yep. Oh, sorry, yeah. There is, I mean, in America at least, we grew up with the narrative that the scheming communists wormed their way into alliances and said they'd let all parties be represented, and then took over. And sometimes with Russian military help, that happened. But there's another thing where these naive guerrilla movements that have been getting airdrop supplies up to 1945 think these guys are their friends. And, you know, as Carlito Brigante says, they ain't no friends in this shit business. And then they found that out in a hurry,
mm-hmm.
because suddenly the British decide this is an evil Chinese-inspired communist conspiracy, and we are going to crush it. Part of their general sense that we can't have lost everything. We have to hold on to this stuff. And they found some interesting ways of doing that. This was a long counterinsurgency. Lasted a decade, really. And they did it pretty effectively, low and slow, only a few thousand deaths on each side. But it, like most of these slow wars, it was also really cruel. And involved a lot of torture and interrogation and betrayal. First of all, they did something that was going to become really, really popular after 1945, after the big change. This was not a war. It was the Malayan emergency that they declared in 1948. The immediate reason for that was there are a lot of European plantation owners in Malaysia, and their policies wouldn't pay off in case of war because it was an act of God or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was just an emergency, the policies would pay off.
Mm.
But as the 20th century went on, people found all kinds of ways to call these things not wars. I mean, when was the last time the U.S. declared war? Has it? I should know this, but...
it's a good question. I mean, we approved, you know, different authorized military, what, so AUM, if the authorization, the use of military force, you know, after 9/11, but they never declared war, no.
No,
authorized, I think, Persian Gulf 1 and 2, I mean, Iraq 1 and 2, but they weren't declarations of war.
No, and people have realized how useful that is. I mean, war is kind of an all or nothing now. Well, supposedly an all or nothing now, like they always say, pregnancy. But an emergency, what's an emergency? You know, you lost your keys. These are very flexible nouns, so that helped. It doesn't get people as upset. So in 1948, the communists of Malaysia start... killing plantation owners because they're being treated really badly, something you find always where these communist uprisings are starting. People are being treated really badly. Mm-hmm. But that's not a problem. The problem is if, you know, you can call them communists and then attribute all their anger to infection by the communist virus, like 28 days later. That was sort of how people thought of it. Like, you know, it's very contagious and you can pick up communism without even knowing it. So they were actually dealing, as it turned out, with a bunch of displaced Chinese settlers who were not allowed to own land, who were hated by the ethnic Malays, who were the British officers' favored collaborators, and who had fled to these squatter camps at the edge of the jungle just to make a living somehow. And the MNLA, the tiny guerrilla army, was in the jungle trying to survive, as those armies do. And the British very patiently thought about what they can do here, because they don't have a lot of troops and they don't want this to be a big war. So they tinkered. They realized they had a couple of advantages. First of all, the Malayan Communist Party was disproportionately Chinese, not Malay. So that's an ethnic thing you can play with. You can warp that back and forth till it breaks. They realized also that these people are being supported by a squatter population that's wretched, poor, has no title to the land, no right to be anywhere. So they do two things. They start awakening Malay Muslim dislike of the Chinese, who tend to be the merchant class. There are actually some similarities there to Jews in Eastern Europe, other non-similarities. And they also evacuate those squatter villages. And eventually they conquered through a lot of things, through a lot of really rough stuff, but mainly through starvation. They were the first post-war imperial power to employ what later became known as Agent Orange. And they just broadcast that poison over any... fields that were thought to be feeding the insurgents. The actual name of the thing is trioxone, but it's, I gather, chemically identical to Agent Orange. And the way they denied that is really interesting. They were accused of biological warfare, and they said, no, this isn't a war. This is a police action, which was also the word for Korea. So you're talking about police business here. You're not talking about war. So it can't be a war crime.
It can't be. It's not. Doesn't fall under Geneva Conventions.
Oh yeah, no, that's
so
for.
Why would you declare war?
Why would you? Yeah, you're just going to get involved in a lot of. Yeah, it's like, you know, rejoining the EU. You just get a lot of regulations jammed down your throat. And they also did something that had been done before and was going to be done again by the U.S. many times. They started just physically moving populations out of areas that supported the guerrillas. to what they called new villages. There used to be a lot of Chinese people in rural Malaysia. And as far as I know, there are not now, because they were all moved out. At the same time, they did the traditional hearts and minds stuff. But the hearts and minds stuff tended to be addressed to the ethnic Malays. The Chinese were seen as the alien element by both the anti-communist imperialists and the ethnic Malays, which was very handy, you know. Yeah. So these were not – the interesting thing here, too, is that these were not jungle people. These were city people who'd been forced out by discriminatory laws and ethnic hatred from the cities of the peninsula and were just squatting really wretchedly at the edge of the jungle. It wasn't like they'd lived there for generations and knew these supposed secret ways of the jungle, if indeed there are any. They were dying of malaria. They had no food. By the sixth year of the war, two-thirds of them were dead or in prison. The number of incidents was falling really quickly. British and auxiliary casualties went down from 200 to 40. And they were clearly winning. They had used a lot of techniques that were going to become really valid. But one of the most amazing things that they did in the Pacific, where they were really short on troops, was actually to use Japanese troops who were left over in parts of the Pacific, because they said, you know, for now, we don't have enough troops over here. Hold on for us, because these guys are communists and we don't want them. That was how seriously the communist threat was taken. Mm-hmm. They were willing to work not just with friends of the people they'd been fighting, but with the people they'd been fighting against the communists. And they played rough. They set out booby-trapped supplies of food, self-detonating grenades, all the things that you can enjoy tinkering with if you're a relatively rich empire and you're fighting in somebody else's village, not yours.
Yeah, that's so I see some similarities to, I guess the first one I should talk about, the American counterinsurgency that was very influential in future strategies, was the one, the anti-hook campaign in the Philippines, in the central Luzon, the main island of the Philippines. But point to that, you know, it's funny, apparently the original kind of godfathers, gurus of American Cold War counterinsurgency strategy really denigrated the British strategies in the melee. Guys like Edward Lansdale was a real sick, demented fuck, you know. what Lansdale and these others said was, they called it both totalitarian and inefficient and too time-consuming. It's so American, actually. So on the one hand, yes, it was totalitarian because it was very centralized, top-down, and the people would feel this kind of, that the British were at the very top of this pyramid, power pyramid down. And so, and they thought that that was bad because the American strategy was presumably about empowering several goons at different levels. And they'd be sort of like counterinsurgency, you know, entrepreneurs. And the market would decide, you know, based on who was having more success, which strategy was more successful. I mean, this kind of neoliberal decentralization theory, it sounds like complete BS to me, but they definitely believed it. But the part that sounds real is they argued that it took too long. And this is very American. It's why we would get frustrated much earlier than, say, the British, you know, would, or even the French. But definitely the British, when they still were running their empire, they had a much longer, you know, time frame on winning these things than we did. We think in terms of quarterly reports, you know, if you've been in the business world. And And in some of these early campaigns, we got sort of lucky and mistook, I mean, I guess you'd call it luck, and mistook that for successful strategy. And at the same time, looked down on the British for it. So
you should tell people what the Hook Rebellion was.
Right. So the Hook Rebellion. So the Hook, I think it's Hook, H-U-K. So this is in the Philippines. It's short for Hukbalahap, which means the People's Anti-Japanese Army. And these were peasants in the rice-growing regions of Luzon, which is the largest, you know, Philippines has several islands. Luzon is the largest island, is where Manila is, the most populous island by far. It has sort of hills, mountains in the north, and then the whole central plain area is mostly rice paddies with some mountains around it. And the peasants started to rebel against the landowners. Again, it's a very similar thing, except we don't have an ethnic element here. In the 1930s, I mean, the peasants were extremely poor, and they were locked into a basically sharecropper existence, where they had to rent the land that they worked on. 98% of the land was owned by 1 or 2% of the landlord class. The peasants had to give up half or more of their crop just in rent every year. So they were always living on the verge of starvation or you know, indebtedness, and on the verge of collapse. And so in the 30s, they started, they were actually not a very radical organization politically. They were mostly asking for pretty moderate land reforms in the 30s and agitating. They were put down then by these kind of private landlord armies, and the security forces, the Philippines local sort of police forces that we had set up when we took over the Philippines as part of the empire that we had in the early 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century. And actually, one of the very first viceroys of the Philippines was none other than General MacArthur's father. So then, World War II comes. General MacArthur is, you know, in command of the Philippines. He has to withdraw. He doesn't like it, but he has to withdraw because the Japanese are too powerful there. And so he puts in place, and this gives you, you know, MacArthur was always a real hardcore reactionary. And a lot of these guys ultimately were fascist sympathizers. They all wanted to fight communists. And fascism was all about fighting communism. They didn't like that they had to fight the fascists. Ultimately fascism got a little out of hand, so they had to, but it was never deep enough.
Well, that's exactly the thing. And that is part of what you called luck there, that in Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, they were dealing with two powers that were so drunk on a faddish and superficial and very cruel ideology that they messed up everywhere they went. And it wasn't hard to be, at least initially, more popular than they had been. Yeah. Even in places in Asia where the British had been disliked or the Americans had been disliked, the Japanese, you know, pretty quickly proved that they weren't going to be much fun to work with either.
Right.
So you could count on them to mess it up, and that gave these guys the feeling that they really knew how to do counterinsurgency.
Right. So MacArthur gave pretty strict orders to some of the commanders he left behind to just go in the hills and basically avoid the Japanese. He didn't want us. I mean, one of the things is MacArthur, because he had roots in the Philippines with the landowning class, with the Americans that were making money off the place. He didn't want some local groups becoming too empowered. He didn't want them throwing off the Japanese yoke. He wanted to be the one that did it, and then he would be able to impose control. So his man, and he put like a corporate lawyer in charge of, you know, one of the southern islands where it's mostly Muslim, and he put another advertising executive, whatever, in charge of forces, made up, composed largely of Filipinos and American officers in Luzon. And in fact, the American forces and the American guerrillas sometimes attacked the Hook. So the Hook wound up being, during World War II, during the Japanese occupation, the only force that was actually regularly targeting and attacking the Japanese occupiers and their collaborators, the Filipino collaborators. And who were the Filipino collaborators? They were essentially the landlords, and the police and the landlord's kind of private armies. I mean, think of, you know, Colombia. Think of how this works in Latin America. It's very similar.
Yeah.
So the hookah became very popular in Luzon because of that. And there were examples, actually, where the U.S.-backed forces and with U.S. commanders actually attacked the hook to prevent them from attacking the Japanese. And that's how serious MacArthur was about this order.
Yeah.
So when we landed in late 1944, when the Americans landed in the Philippines and started to fight to take it over, we did ally with the hook then. And they acted, they helped clear areas, they were eyes and ears, and they were allies. But already, even by February of 1945, there's this famous incident, locally famous anyway, in which some of the hook returning through cleared villages, so these were areas that had been already liberated, forces under the United States, it wasn't actually American commanders, but it was the USA, I can't remember the acronym, but it was our forces there. They stopped, it was 109 hook people, 110. They stopped them, disarmed them, interrogated them, made them dig a mass grave and shot and killed them all. And,
wow.
And that's because these guys came from the landlord class, and they saw the hook as communist. And it was pretty clear that, you know, that the Japanese were going to be thrown out, and so they wanted to get a leg up on this.
Yeah, that's one thing to keep in mind here, that suddenly Germany and Japan, which had seemed so fearsome, are just gone. And you have to imagine a completely new map. And suddenly you don't feel so idealistic and Jimmy Stewart anymore. You're starting to think about how you're going to make some money out of this.
Yeah.
And how you're going to control some territory.
And how you're going to...
And that happened really fast.
Yes, yes. And the smart ones, especially, saw the angles on this pretty fast. And if you knew MacArthur, you knew that things were not going to be hugely different than under the Japanese. It was just going to be the general ideals would be different, but the structure of power in place was going to be pretty similar. It was going to be the landlords ruling things with a large imperial power behind them. Yeah. So MacArthur, what he does is he arrests his forces, arrests a lot of the collaborators and the hook leadership as well. And then MacArthur starts letting the collaborators go, and then there are protests, so he has to release the leader of the hook, Louis Tarouk, I think is how you pronounce his name. So he's released in late 1945, and he's released under the condition that they're going to hold elections, and everything's going to be different under the Americans. But in order to participate in the elections, he's going to have to, the hook leader is going to have to give them a list of all the names of the hook party members and everybody in their structure, because that's what political parties do, and it was all very bureaucratic. So he did, and then, as I said earlier, immediately they start getting picked off one by one. Blacklists are created. Landlords start removing, you know, peasants who are on these lists. They start getting disappearing in the middle of the night. And one of the people that MacArthur releases is Manuel Rojas. Roxas or Rojas? It's with an X. I assume it's Rojas. He was an extremely wealthy landlord, and he was a big-time collaborator. He was the Minister of Economy and Rice Production under the Japanese, and he's MacArthur's handpicked man to become the new president in 1946.
And that's a huge job for the Japanese, because that's what they want from the Philippines. That's all they want.
Oh, yeah.
Rice and no trouble.
Yep. So Rojas, so they have the elections. Rojas becomes president. The hook create a larger party, and they win 7 seats in the parliament. Rojas decides he's not going to seat a single one of them, and he calls them all terrorists. So then they withdraw, and they start trying to negotiate in 1946 some kind of political agreement. And then one of the negotiators, this is going on, they're still getting killed, and one of the negotiators then disappears during a negotiation, and he's found later just with a headless corpse. And at that point, the hook leadership decides this is not getting anywhere. We got to run for the hills. So they reformed, went into the mountains, went into the hills, and decided to fight.
This, by the way, is a classic moment in all the stories we're going to be talking about today. There's the moment when the group that's been seeing these people as their allies from overseas suddenly has to realize they're not our friends anymore.
Yeah. So this is where our new Cold War counterinsurgency ideas start to be tested in different ways, and where a guy named Edward Lansdale really distinguishes himself, because the Hook insurgency is eventually defeated in a shorter period of time than the Brits in Malay, and I'll get to why in a minute. Lansdale is this advertising executive.
he's a great character. You got to describe this guy.
Yeah, he's like a sick madman, you know, bastard, and an advertising executive. Thinks he's very clever. He's really into pranks. He's really into the idea that that terror must be used to pacify or reorient peasant regions where they might be. Let's say that they might be sympathetic to the Hooks, so they might be siding with the communists or the Hooks. So you need to terrorize them, but in these funny ways that he called funny and humorous. So one of these
a 30 second spot of ultra violence.
Yeah, exactly. And he loved to brag about his different ways of psychological warfare and counter terror. But here are some examples of the quote pranks that that Lansdale boasts about. Oh, I should also add that Lansdale was apparently the the Pyle from The Quiet American was based on Lansdale, and right. And Green didn't get him right. What's clear when you understand Lansdale better is Lansdale played up to a certain expectation of what a snotty imperialist Brit like Graham Greene would think of an American like Lansdale, which is naive.
Yeah, absolutely. And The Quiet American is one of the sickest novels in the career of the very sick mind of Graham Greene. And it just reeks of sexual jealousy mixed up with imperial spite at being the eclipsed power, mm-hmm. and a really unhealthy mixture of all kinds of passive rages and jealousies. And it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't tell you anything about Vietnam. And I mean, I've always thought Green was just a fool, really, and that novel demonstrates it. And I'm sure Lansdale was laughing at him.
Yes, I know. So so here's what Lansdale liked to brag, actually, to some people that he knew better. I mean, another weird thing is he was very close to Daniel Ellsberg. He called Daniel Ellsberg his number one best platoon leader he ever had in these counter-terror missions that they did in Vietnam.
Wow.
And Ellsberg, I mean, I went back and read some of his memoirs, and he just stayed loyal to Lansdale right up to the end. He puts him in a much better light than he really deserves. He's a sick fuck. So anyway, so one of the things that Lansdale boasted about doing to the Hook was he found out that the peasants there are very superstitious and terrified of vampires, and a lot of vampire stories. So they would wait when a Hook patrol would go by. They'd ambush the last guy. They'd jab his jugular with two holes. I think one of the people on Lansdale's team said there's no greater terror weapon than two ice picks lashed together in a jugular. And so they'd do that. Then they'd hang this Hook guy upside down, drain him of all of his blood, and then have, you know, and put it somewhere near the village so that when somebody walked by, they would see it and think, oh, my God, a vampire, you know, just bit this guy and drained his blood. And the patrol, both the soldiers and the villagers would flee. They were also trying to, you know, empty out certain villages there. This is part of counterinsurgency strategy. Another thing he did that he loved to brag about and that he found very funny was... in one village, there was sort of, there was a courier, a sympathetic courier between the village where some of the foodstuffs were grown and then the hills a bit further away where the Hook guerrillas were. And this courier was caught after bringing some supplies to them. And he was interrogated by Lansdale's people. And he was tape recorded while he was interrogated. And he confessed to everything. And then he was murdered. And then his body was brought back out to the trail that he would normally go on to go from the Hook to his village and left there and then until he was found by some local villager. And then they spread rumors to their people within this large village that it was actually the hook that killed him. So that kind of messed him up, and they buried him.
That sounds like the counterinsurgency episode of Scooby-Doo.
I know. Yeah, it's weird frat boy pranks taken to their, you know, horrific extreme. So anyway, so then so the villagers bury this guy, and then in the middle of the night, they set up these loudspeakers and put in the tape recorder in it, and the villagers all of a sudden hear from the cemetery this guy confessing to all of his crimes. His voice, and they didn't know what a tape recorder was or loudspeakers.
Right.
And the entire village just screamed and fled, and it was completely cleared the next day.
Yeah, that would have been a great imperial joke of the perfect kind. Like, you think of yourself as a higher order of being, mm-hmm. with access to this technology that seems magical. There's an old sci-fi axiom: sufficiently advanced technology always seems like magic. And here, you know, in the mid-20th century, if you think the peasants are as poor and deprived as they probably were, you can do it with just a couple of amplifiers and a tape recorder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another thing that Lansdale did, and this was probably much more effective, was when he came out to be an advisor to the defense minister of the Philippines in 49-50, sort of at the peak of the counterinsurgency against the hook. He said that he made sure this guy moved out of his house and moved into the barracks with him, so that Lansdale literally lived and bunked in the same room with this guy. He said either myself or one of, you know, my men, he was never left alone, ever. You know, maybe a couple hours a day maximum. And so, you know, he was, it's not just camaraderie. I mean, this is how cults are made. You become, yeah, very deeply tied to these people. They made him, you know, president shortly afterwards. They definitely won control and loyalty over him, and then had a lot more control over the forces by having that physically very close relationship with him.
Yeah.
Another thing they did. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. And so when we're talking about the Hook Rebellion, as you said, we're talking about rural Luzon, right?
Yes.
And it's just one region of one island in a, yes, multi-island country.
And one ethnic group, too.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound, from the way you're describing them, like they were very good at inter-ethnic or international propaganda. It sounds like they were more of the traditional peasant revolt, like stop treating us like garbage, stop taking all our crops, or we'll stab you with a pitchfork, that kind of stuff.
Exactly, and that's really why they lost. I mean,
yeah.
So Lansdale, being an ad man, took all this great credit for it and was considered a genius. And JFK, for example, thought this guy's the future. He was wowed by him. Another slick, you know, one slick guy to another slick guy, talking all kinds of futuristic psychological warfare BS. In fact, it was just old-style terror. And the fact that the Hook were a very localized rebellion. They weren't actually Marxists, even though Lansdale and the official policy was, these are Marxists, they're part of an international conspiracy, that's why we must kill them all and, you know, defeat them. In fact, they weren't, and that's why they were defeated. They were just a local rebellion wanting a better deal from the landlords. And so it was a,
yeah,
lot easier to isolate them. It was not a Philippines-wide peasant rebellion. It was only in the central Luzon area. So yeah, it took some years. But
I was going to say, I've had the weird experience just recently of reading Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath for the first time. I think most people read it in high school, but hell, it's probably banned from Pleasant Hill. And so much of what he describes here can be seen in the way strikes are broken for farm workers in California in the 1930s. And a lot of that novel involves like the absolute certainty that this is going to end with a communist revolution and it's going to be bloody, that even though Steinbeck was very comfortable himself in his origins, that strong sense of, we're not going to get away with this, mm-hmm. that we can't get away with it, with killings, strike leaders, killing labor leaders. And there's a great scene where people are discussing what they mean by red, which is what Okies think of as communists. And somebody says, well, I worked for a big rancher. He's got 100,000 acres. And I said, Mr. So-and-so, what's a red? And he says, a red is anybody who wants 25 cents an acre when who wants 30 cents an acre when we're paying 25.
We should almost do a show on Steinbeck once, because there's a really good book. You know, what you find is that the communists can be really, really impressive so long as they never take power in a lot of areas, including including in the Central Valley in California. I mean, they were the only ones. The Steinbeck, again, you know, airbrushed all this out of history, but it was really the communists, some very impressive people led by a young woman from Tennessee, actually, or Georgia, who really organized them when nobody else would, when the AFL wouldn't get near them, because it was mostly minorities, and they just kind of understood that they were going to get screwed. It was going to be brutal and violent, which it was. The communists like that.
He leaves out any non-white people. Well, with one exception, Native Americans are included. Mm. That's really interesting, because I've seen that in people who are otherwise white people who are otherwise very reactionary. It's like they're pro-Native American in some strange abstract way. But I mean, what I mean is, this isn't so alien as it might seem to readers from the U.S. Yes. To listeners from the U.S. I mean, this is just what you do when you don't want to pay your farm workers anything. They've been terrorizing farm workers in this way for God knows how many centuries, and the same strategies always recur to people. But now you got this term, communism, to mess with.
Right.
Before, you probably had the term godless. And pretty soon you're going to have godless communist.
That's right. So, and the other thing to remember as well, which you pointed out, is that peasants tend to be conservative, very conservative. And that's true, you know, most places, including here. So it's not easy to, you know, to turn them on to communism. It's a lot easier to turn them on to the ideas of justice. I mean, if you are... I mean, this is the same that the populists in America in the late 19th century that they had to deal with. They're very conservative, but they were also drowning in debt. They were put under debt, this Kropotkin system and the gold standard. All this stuff had millions of farmers living in just utter debt and destitution, and that kind of overcomes a lot of, you know... a lot of barriers you might have when you're that poor, and it never is going to end.
Well, you know, you go back and you find peasant rebellions in Catholic countries around someone who's been talked to by a saint, around in Protestant countries and someone who's been talked to directly by Jesus, because they don't go for the saint stuff. You find false czars, you find caliphs, you find whatever the local culture provides you with when you need to make a seismic change. There's always a resource in the culture you can use.
Right. So one of the facets of this counterinsurgency strategy was a fake land reform. And I wonder, basically the land, they were trying, the Americans, the Lansdale Zone, were trying to get the landlords to at least do some kind of minimal land reform and minimal easing the burden on the peasants, not because we were any good, but because we thought that would drain the swamp, that would, you know, hurt the insurgency. And the landlords, being landlords, said no effing way. No, we're not going to do it. We're not going to give them 1 inch. You can't give these people an inch. They refused to. So what we came up with was some kind of program where Hook rebels who would surrender would be given some land down in a southern island. And
Mindanao.
Exactly, Mindanao, which is the more Muslim area. But it was literally like 100 or 200 maybe who were allowed into this program, who were given land. And then each one of them became this, basically was put into a speaker's bureau. And part of the condition was they'd have to go back to all these Hook villages and talk about the land that they had. And that did actually have an effect. The people believed it. They show them photos and say how great it was, and I have land. Well, that's what they wanted. And we quickly realized, well, wait, we don't have enough land to give to everybody. So then we said, okay, you have to both surrender and become a counterinsurgent and kill a lot of Hooks before you even get anything. And so ultimately very few were given land, but our counterinsurgency people said nevertheless it was like a factor of, you know, 10 or 100 to 1 in terms of each person we gave land to, at least another 10 up to 100 people thought, wow, that's a good idea, and kind of it demoralized them or lessened their enthusiasm for the Hook Rebellion a little bit.
And one thing that shows that's really common in these counterinsurgency efforts is the doublethink that these counterinsurgency specialists yes. have going on in their heads. On the one hand, they're telling Washington or London or Paris or whoever, these guys are hardcore communists. They've been infected with the communist virus. That's all they care about. On the other hand, you realize they're just peasants who've had this generations-long dream for a piece of land that they can work. And if you give them that, actually, they'll stop.
Yes. Yeah, and what's funny, I mean, one study I read on this, it would quote sort of different versions by the same people, like Lansdale or CIA, you know, and so there'd be like the classified cables, the official doctrine, and then even some private diaries. And they all told somewhat different stories, like Lansdale in a private diary would say, yeah, they're just peasants and they should. And then, but in secret cables and officially, he would say, these guys are hardcore Marxists and we need to wipe them out. But then, you know, then you have to think about, we always talk about, well, you have to understand this culture, that culture. What about American culture? You have to understand the culture of advertising executive frat boy sociopath. And so these different things can coexist. And I think he's thinking, well, I get ahead this way, but I also know this. I'm also a bullshitter. I also think I know everything. You know, they're not mutually exclusive.
Now, look, we both come from the rhetoric department at UC Berkeley. Okay, that was mostly, in effect, a pre-law undergraduate program. And I remember, and, you know, I'm gonna unload an epiphanic experience here, man. It was like, I guess, the mid-1980s, and I went with some people from the rhetoric program who within a few years were going to be very rich corporate lawyers who could buy and sell me and have me kicked around on a soccer field for spare change. But we went to see the film Aliens, and I'm sure people have seen that film. I mean, Ridley Scott with a flamethrower saying, get away from her, you bitch, and everybody going, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. And there's an evil corporate executive.
You mean Sigourney Weaver.
Sigourney Weaver, yeah.
Would have been interesting if it was Ridley Scott. Get away from her, you bitch.
God. Sigourney Weaver, who brings back another anecdote I heard from you once. Okay.
Yes.
But anyway, Sigourney Weaver is the hero of the film. The bad guy is a corporate executive caricature played by a sort of blinky, nervous guy who was in a sitcom called Mad About You. Are all these shows called Mad something? I don't know. Anyway, there's a scene where he, as a coward and a corporate stooge, leaves everyone to their deaths and tries to flee. But of course, he flees right into a closet with one of the aliens in there. And the scene is really drawn out. So you get a long time to watch him doing a reaction shot and the alien opening set of jaws number one and then set of jaws number two and then clamping on his face. And all these future corporate lawyers are going, yeah!
Exactly.
And, you know, I go back to a film seminar or something, and it's like this movie expresses the anti-corporate sentiment that runs so deep in American culture. It runs about a fucking millimeter deep. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people are capable of enjoying that moment as a piece of entertainment. They're also capable of knowing exactly what they got to do to get into a good law school and of spending all those hours in that windowless law library just so they can make partners someday. I mean, yeah, we are not as naive as we like to pretend.
Yeah. Right-wing deadheads.
Yeah.
Corporate deadheads. I mean, tons of them. That's what always blows me away, but that's a thing.
Yep.
Right. So,
sorry, I diverted you there.
That was
an epiphany. You know,
it was. No, it's true though. So another strategy, and this is very relevant, up through today and in Ukraine and so on, is was the use, co-optation and use and kind of weaponization of what were called volunteer civilian guards in central Luzon. So these were private armies funded by wealthy landlords, and they had ex-military or military on loan people mixed in with these private armies. And they turned out to be really useful for counterinsurgency for a bunch of reasons. One is they were ideologically vetted for being crazy violent, so anti-communists and anti-peasants, and violently hated the peasants. So whereas normal recruits might be normal people, not deeply indoctrinated in ideas or predisposed to being wanting to massacre any peasant who asks for, you know, a better deal from his landlord. These guys were like that. Now, some of them were drawn from the ranks of the Japanese collaboration units and police. Some of them were, there was a description of these volunteer civilian guards. An officer described them as, quote, local gangsters, goons, people of bad reputations out to make good with the law to avoid punishment or out to make a living. And it also allowed the central government in this period after the war, when things were still shaky, to have some distance from the really ugly part of counterinsurgency. They'd say, right, yeah, we're trying to bring these guys under control. We're working on it. We're going to centralize them. You know, you can disband one of these groups when they've massacred a village. And that makes the center look good when they do bring them under control or integrate them into a system. And the reason, yeah, you know, why, and this is also used in Greece, and I think it's used in a lot of areas. And what they found is, we found this is also used in El Salvador. Yeah. I mean, the having National Guard groups or volunteer battalions, whatever you call them, with backing from oligarchs, sometimes not, but in particular vetted for political ideology, they're really useful for doing the sick shit of counterterrorism, basically counterinsurgency.
Yeah.
And
yeah, they might not be good frontline troops, but yes, that's not what you want. You want someone who will do horrible things and spread terror. Yes. Like when they stuck the two ice picks in that guy's neck. I mean, okay, let's look at that as a military tactic. You kill one person you consider an enemy, you take no casualties, it costs you no money, and you get rid of an entire enemy village. Mm-hmm. It's very practical.
Yep. And this and there are other examples, but for me, one of the things this immediately brings to mind is this starts to explain some of the strategies I think we've seen with the Ukraine government after the Maidan Revolution. I mean, first of all, the Maidan Revolution really did rely a lot on, unlike the 2004 Orange Revolution, the 2014 one relied on a lot of extreme right, fascist, neo-fascist, far ultra-nationalist muscle to happen. And then when the Russians helped spark the sort of the pro-Russian separatist movement in the eastern part, in the Donbass region, if you remember, initially, Poroshenko or Yatsenyuk or Turchinov. Anyway, the Maidan revolutionary, the new government, sent in regular forces, not into Crimea because they couldn't take it, but into the Donbass area. And villagers, you know, middle-aged people, women, so they would go and lie out in front of the tanks and in front of the BMPs and not let them through. And the Ukrainian regular recruits wouldn't fire on them, wouldn't shoot them.
Wow.
So initially, they couldn't do anything. So,
yeah,
they pulled them back. Their air forces would start to fire because, as we know, anybody who flies a plane is a jerk.
Yep.
But the regular recruits who knew these people, they spoke the same language, they couldn't do it. So they pulled them back, and that's when we started to see the appearance of what were called volunteer battalions. Right. And you had the Azov Battalion, which is probably the most fearsome, and it's also openly neo-Nazi, Nazi emblems, openly Banderite. But then other ones, the Idar Battalion, the Donbass Battalion, all these extreme right ideologically extreme right battalions, full of people who were emptied out of some jails, and backed by oligarchs like Kolomoisky, who's now out of favor, but at that time he was a big funder of some. He's Jewish and he's a big funder of neo-Nazi battalions. These are very cynical things. And these guys would go in, and they're essentially, they may not have killed the numbers. Well, 10,000 people have died so far. They may not have killed in the numbers that your standard death squad killed in. But they're designed as death squads. And they have mercenaries, and they have former, ex-servicemen. I mean, this is where Nadia Savchenko comes in. She's, she was a helicopter pilot. She was with coalition forces. She was under U.S. command in Iraq. Then she came back, and after the revolution, she became a volunteer trainer. She was a trainer at the Idar Battalion, which is full of neo-Nazis. Now she's kind of interesting. Now she's been out of jail, she's talking interesting peace talk. I mean, a lot of times the smarter monsters know when to call peace. And that might be her. I don't know. But she's certainly no Nelson Mandela. But in any event, this is an old strategy. I mean, what these guys, these far right people, and they're very consciously encouraged through symbolism and through torchlit marches and so on, and also Right Sector, which is very openly Banderaite and neo-Nazi. These were the guys who went in and actually did fight and did kill, and they had no problem killing. And I there's this one American guy with them who was killed. He was a West Point graduate. He was an older guy, Ukrainian. Mark Gregory Poloska, I think his name was. He was wound up being killed in that brutal counteroffensive in Ilyanovsk, when a lot of Ukrainians were just wiped out. But in any event, I remember seeing, before he was killed, some of his quotes. He's like, I hate Russia. Like he got angry at somebody who offered a cigarette to a captured Russian. He said, what the hell are you doing? I hate these people. I want to kill all of them. This is their mentality. They want to kill and wipe out all the Russians. They think all of the problems is a genetic thing, Those people will do counterinsurgency stuff that regular troops can't be counted on to do.
And that was a very popular idea in the region, even among respectable intellectual circles until recently. And the idea that the notion that this idea has vanished just because it ain't respectable is crazy.
Yeah.
Ideas don't vanish like that. It's still a good, simple explanation for a lot of hate. And those guys probably are carrying around a lot of hate. Some of them come from all over, too. I've heard the Azov Battalion is recruited from, Canada?
Canada, Sweden, Austria. Russian. I think one of their heroes, it's not Beletsky. I can't remember his name now. He's either Russian or Belarusian. Some of the Russian Nazis, they're kind of split on this. And there are, there's like far right Russians, and there are very many strands of it. And some of them they sided with the Ukrainians because, they're more pure Nazi, I guess, than what, the separatist forces were kind of mixed up with communist ideology and kind of left anarchist ideology and then monarchist, kind of old monarchist,
I hear they're. I hear that they've even got Cossacks, whatever Cossacks are.
I know.
I mean, there's not much left of the Cossacks from what I hear, but whatever little dwindled grandchildren of the Cossacks still exist are trying to join up there.
Yeah, and I kind of lost respect for the guy. I was down in Rostov once, and hanging out with some Cossacks and. I literally drank them under the table, and when a Jew drinks a Cossack under the table, that's bad times for the Cossacks. Like, hang your heads in shame at that point.
An American Jew at that.
Yeah, they were impressed, and I was very contemptuous of them. You guys, you're the ones that drove my family, my grandmother's family out here. You can't even drink me under the table. What the hell's going on here?
Wow, God, that is sad. I remember a story Limonov told also about the Cossack obsession with Jews, where he said, look, you're surrounded by all kinds of enemies here, and all you do is go on about Jews. And they just give him this sort of cross-eyed blink for a few seconds and then say, perhaps you, Limonov, are a Jew.
Yeah, yeah, I remember him saying that. He said, Edward Vinyaminovich, what kind of name is that? Yeah. He thought, God, I hate these people. God, they're so stupid. So in any event, you know, for reasons that have a lot to do with Lansdale's powers of persuasion, the Hook Rebellion was pretty much extinguished by 50-51. The leader turned himself in by 54. There was nothing going on by that point anyway. And he surrendered. And so that was considered by the U.S. one of these great success stories. Big-time success story. And all these lessons then were, you know, formalized in manuals and used then. And then Lansdale himself is kind of the pitch man for this kind of counterinsurgency. He then became sort of the main guy in Vietnam. And when things went bad, you know, he started to say, well, it's because you're not listening to me, you know.
He sounds a lot like the lines they gave Brando while he was sweating his face off in Apocalypse Now. Terror is your friend, or it is an enemy to be feared. Well, yes. You know, you try doing that vampire trick with the North Vietnamese army or the Viet Cong and see how scared they get. They're just not going to fall for that.
Yeah. I mean, you've seen their, talk about traps. I mean, the bamboo sticks and the scorp. I mean, God, they were pretty inventive.
Like, they had underground hospitals dug out with shovels. I mean, they were an urban people for a very long time with a history of fighting big empires. They were not parochial in the way the Hook seemed to have been. And that advertising nonsense is just not going to work.
Yeah. Yep, and it didn't. But again, Lansdale was had a big mouth. I think Kennedy for a while brought him into the White House, then put him in charge of the Operation Mongoose, I guess. So after the failure of the Bay of Pigs, they needed to keep these crazy Cubans busy for a while, and they did. You know, they had all these stupid assassination programs with Castro. Probably backfired. And Lansdale was kind of running these guys for a while before he went back to Vietnam.
Was a government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. So I immediately concluded, the Philippines is a part of that, from this world of Lincoln, that all the world, all humanity must enjoy democracy. That's another incentive for me to read further, and I memorize your Declaration of Independence, that we hold these things to be self-evident, that all men were created equal, that they were endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. My gosh, I said, we must have this in the Philippines, because the way our government was run was still the remnant of Spanish colonialism, and then, during my days, the landlords were still in power. What happened with these Americans who say they will help us to be free? They have sanctioned, coddled, preserved into office these landlords and these feudal landlords and selfish people who were also serving the Spaniards during their time. So that was the quandary I was in. And under the Americans, still they allowed the charts to own lands, and we were tenants of the charts, and we were treated very badly. For every sack of unhusked rice, not yet ready to cook, newly harvested, you have to pay 2 or 3 sacks of unhusked rice 3 months after. For 1 peso that we borrowed, you have to pay 1 sack of rice, or 1 sack of rice, you have to pay 8 sacks of unhusked rice. We call that the worst kind of usury. we have terms in Filipino to that system, and it made me, even at a very young age, a rebel in my mind against that system. So as I was growing, I tried to look for venue to my feelings, at least to vindicate the sufferings of my parents who were victims of that kind of maltreatment by the landlords and the church. The situation then in our social and economic life, we were treated so badly by the landlords who owned the land, and including the church that maintained its ownership of the land, tolerated by the new occupying power, American domination. And so we were so insecure that the landlord or even the church can drive us away any moment, even cause our houses to be demolished, little huts of the peasants, of the farm workers to be demolished. They have dogs, they have guns, they have goons to hurt us if we don't submit to their will, or they have to drive us away. So the very excessive, usurious way of lending us for our sustenance was very bad. And it is one of the reasons why the peasants rebelled even in my time as a young boy growing in our barrio or villages in central Luzon, which eventually became the most rebellious of all the regions, of all the provinces in the Philippines. And I was wondering myself, at myself, why a sort of gay boy, not so really macho, not really a firebrand at that, I have always been soft-spoken and tender in my feelings. But I was chosen to organize the Hukbalahap, the biggest guerrilla army in the Philippines that fought the Japanese like Tito during the war.
Let's bring it up to El Salvador, because I think everything that you've said fits fine with El Salvador.
Yes, yes, yes.
First of all, we've got the social structure you need for one of these really bloody revolutions, where you've got 1% of the population owning 90% of the land and having owned it for many generations. 60% of the population owns no land at all and never will. So you got a grossly unfair situation. Peasants want land. Most of the peasants are never going to get land. They see the people who own the land as complete aliens, and the people who own the land see them as, to be honest, vermin who are investing the land. It's that brutal. It was a very brutal country. But that's not the way we heard it when, you know, people my age were going through the early years of the Reagan era. What we heard was that there was a communist revolution in El Salvador that had to be stamped out because there was also trouble in Nicaragua and it was moving up the border. And if you remember a great little movie, speaking about the kind of guys who joined death squads, Red Dawn, that featured Nicaraguan troops as well as Cuban troops, I think, moving up to take Colorado, their ancient dream. And what actually happened is the El Salvador was a poor agricultural country. The 1973 oil crisis hit the very poor peasants there and made it harder for them to buy fertilizer to grow anything on their worn-out cornfields. And finally, one of the smarter aristocrats, the president, Arturo Armando Molina, said, as smarter aristocrats tend to do, look, we got to make a compromise here, or we're going to have real trouble. And when you've got a landed aristocracy that's been in power for hundreds of years, despises the people under them, thinks of them as ethnically alien, you know what they're going to say. They're going to say, no, go to hell. We'll just hire some off-duty soldiers to kill these people. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. There were elections in theory, but the elections didn't mean much of anything because there were thugs under hire, most of them in the employ of the big ranchers and the big landowners. And when there were protests by the usual coalition of peasants and well-meaning middle-class leftist students, they were killed. There was a big protest in 1977, and students were killed, along with peasants whose lives didn't make the news as much, but there were about 200 of them overall. They were killed by flat-out death squads and strange sort of miniature El Salvadoran-style death squads because it's a small country. One of them was the FAR, which actually grew, I shouldn't even laugh about this stuff, but somehow grew out of a Boy Scout troop and was later taken over directly by the government's intelligence service. They murdered union leaders, activists, students, teachers, anyone who sympathized with the left. And what those people are saying is not, let's reenact Moscow 1920 and extreme Bolshevism. What they're saying is, look, we got to give these people something. We can't go on forever not giving them anything, just killing them if they raise their voice. And even that was too much. Even that was too much for these people to handle.
It's a common thing, yeah, isn't it? Because I guess if you think about it from the landlord, sociopathic landlord's point of view, if it's possible for a second. But I mean, you're thinking, okay, you've already spilled blood. You know what forces you have on your side. You think, if I give something to them that will actually keep them quiet, first of all, you know, once you give them an inch, they're going to want to take a mile. But if I give them something, it's going to have to be something actual and real. It's going to actually have to be a piece of my wealth, my family's, you know, our wealth, I'll have to give up to these people. So how much do I give? And then you get, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 of influential, arrogant landowner, wealthy landowners in a room together. You think they're going to be talking about what's fair, you know, to give up, how much they should give up to be really fair to, like... No, they're going to convince each other they got to wipe them all out.
And particularly when you're talking about land, because peasants are the only people who get crazy about land. A lot of people are that way. And there's no incentive. It's worked in the past anyway. I mean, you've maintained power for a long time by hiring off-duty soldiers to kill them. But something a little odd happens in the Carter years. And to give Carter credit, he appointed as ambassador to El Salvador a decent old school diplomat named Robert E. White, who became so depressed by what he'd seen in El Salvador that he later said a great thing about all these American anti-communist counterinsurgency. Here's a quote from Robert E. White. In the name of anti-communism, U.S.-supported armies suppressed democracy, free speech, and human rights in El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Panama. Torture and assassination of democratic leaders, including presidential candidates, journalists, priests, and union officials, became commonplace. So he was telling the truth, and it was not an easy thing to do. Though it was a lot easier to do in 1979 than it was in 1980 when Reagan became president. Mm-hmm. First thing he did in El Salvador was get rid of that guy. Mm-hmm. This Carter ambassador had described one of the leaders of the death squads, Roberto d'Aubuisson, it's originally a French name, as a pathological killer with a sick mind. That's a quote. Reagan's new ambassador described him as a really important leader. So the change of regime, that's one of the things you have to fear when you're an insurgency. You have very little control over your own destiny. There's a bigger, stronger country, and things are happening there too, and those are going to affect what happens to you. Nobody in 1980 understood how much it meant that Reagan was in and Carter was out. But El Salvador found out, because that guy who'd been criticized as a pathological killer by Carter's people soon became the president of El Salvador, Roberto d'Aubuisson. He was the man who had ordered the assassination of Archbishop Romero in his church while saying mass. And meanwhile, the shaky little revolutionary junta in El Salvador was getting clobbered. They tried to do a little land reform program, and the aristocrats who owned the land said, no, we'll kill every cow we got. We'll move our farm equipment over the border. We'll do anything. We won't give an inch.
Yeah. That's standard, too.
Yeah, as we said. Very standard. Yeah. And the death squads after, I mean, D'Aubusson was arrested after killing the archbishop. You don't quite kill an archbishop. That's mm-hmm. That's a bit of a thing. But he was released. And once Reagan was in, the big massacres really started. Twice during this civil war in El Salvador, civilians were trying to flee the country across a river, and twice they were attacked, once by aircraft, once by small arms from Salvadoran troops, and just slaughtered in the stream. Eventually, the left-wing groups formed their own militia. But, you know, you never get the sense in El Salvador or a lot of Central America that these left-wing militias quite have the stomach for the sort of things you were describing that the right-wing death squads do. They seem to have weird qualms at times. Today, by the way, FARC, the biggest of the Colombian revolutionary militias, officially signed a peace treaty. And the moment when FARC became most popular in Colombia was when it started killing right-wing death squad guys. Mm. But these left-wing groups are stubborn about that. They don't like to do it. They don't like to get drawn into that kind of war because the class lines are messy or this and that. I wish they were a little, you know, a little less squeamish. But anyway, so the massacres begin to really, really pick up. There's now an armed revolution, which has been entirely brought about by the people who own the country. In the province of Morazan. And as I pointed out in an article long ago, this was actually covered by a young reporter for CBS called Bill O'Reilly. And what he saw was buildings burned down by communist maniacs. What he didn't see is 1,000 Mayan villagers killed in cold blood by the Aroclal battalion of the El Salvadoran army. And there are records of these guys. It speaks to what you said about needing special people to do this kind of war. One of the soldiers says to another, you know, some of those kids in there are really cute. I don't want to kill them. We killed all the old men and women, but I don't want to kill these kids. And the other one says, are you crazy? If we don't kill them, they'll kill us. Mm-hmm. The orders are to kill everybody in the village. And, of course, Carter's not innocent in this either. He increased military aid to El Salvador, even though he knew it was going to be used to kill villagers.
Carter's the massacre, waffling again, right?
Yeah, classic Carter waffling, yeah. So the army begins sweeping the mountainous villages where they think the revolution is strongest. They do it with terror. If they think a village is supporting the revolutionaries, they kill everybody. These guys were trained at School of the Americas, which was where a lot of Latin officers learned how to do counterinsurgency. So you have to assume they were following policy. I was using the wrong name for the massacre. It's El Mozote, not Morazan. Mm-hmm. So it's El Mozote massacre. That happened in December 1981. And again, you try to drain the sea. You don't want these villagers there. You kill a few villages, and the word spreads to the other, and they flee across the border. They fled to Honduras. You don't care what happens to them there. They can die or not die. It's up to them. But what you've done is make the whole place a free fire zone, so you can kill anybody in it, and there's no food left there because there's no peasant to hand you some food after dark. Mm-hmm. So the revolution goes on. It's very one-sided. The left-wing FMLN tries to kill soldiers, and the soldiers stand around at sentry points during the daytime and then change their clothes and go out and kill villagers at night, which is a very, very common pattern. Mm-hmm. There's no reciprocity here. It's you can't pretend that there is. But meanwhile, what I heard, and I say this with some bitterness because I was quite the little dupe at the time. I didn't particularly care about Central America, for one thing, and it sounded depressing. And it didn't particularly strike home. It was one of those things people brought up from time to time, but it seemed far away. And I say that with real shame, but it did. And like everyone who grew up in my era in the United States, I did think of communism as like some contagion from 28 days later. And that makes no sense. I can't explain it. It was a necessary fiction for the people who really ran the place. Mm-hmm. And now it's one that I suppose can be dispensed with. So, you know, the war goes on and on through Reagan's first term. And then somebody in the CIA or the State Department decides Roberto d'Aubuisson is a lunatic. And he really was. Absolute lunatic. We need somebody a little more cosmetic. So they get
d'Aubuisson was like a favorite of the Jesse Helms wing of the Republican Party.
Yeah. Though, who were very strong at the time. Yeah. So they get Jose Napoleon Duarte, who was more Christian. The CIA puts $2 million into his campaign. And all the stuff goes on, but it's a little slower. And there aren't so many swollen bodies in the streets for the cameras to film. Eventually there's a peace treaty and nothing has changed. This is, again, what you could call a counterinsurgency triumph, because they do another survey in 1989. 1% of the landowners still own 40% of the useful land, 60% of the rural population, mostly the ones who speak Mayan rather than Spanish and who look like Mayans rather than Hispanic people, own 0%. Mm-hmm. Then it's really all over. In 1991, Bush Sr. gives another $42.5 million aid to the Salvadoran Armed Forces, who've been moonlighting as death squads all this time. Finally, there's a peace accord in 1992. But what's happened is that at tremendous cost of blood and, to me at least, shame, a horrible situation has been kept in place, which raises the question that you have to ask about all these post-war counterinsurgencies. If communism was really such a powerful contagion and you'd let it develop, what would have happened? I mean, I don't think it would have invaded Omaha in the same form that it invaded parts of El Salvador or parts of Vietnam. It's hard now to summon up the fear that all that created. And I really don't know what was supposed to be going to happen.
No, that's really true. I mean, the way that the ideology just collapsed on itself without much blood, made it easy to forget, and people aren't scared. I mean, it's just amazing to me that Bernie Sanders, again, got as far as he did, with photos of him with Soviet communists in Albania in the 1980s and being a supporter of the Sandinistas, because I do remember how crazy it was. I remember how crazy I even was then. And it also, to bring it to Ukraine a little bit, I mean, it shows kind of the usefulness of what the Nazis and then the Ukrainians as well did with anti-communism, which was they personified it in an ethnic group. So with the Nazis, it was much more personifying it in the Jew. With Ukrainians, it was personifying communism with Muscovy Jiddi, Moscow, you know, Muscovite Jews. Mm. That's why you'll hear people even from their far right party, Svoboda. Sometimes people didn't even understand where it came from. They'd start denouncing in the Rada and the parliament, the Muscovy Jewish mafia, the Muscovy Jewish this. Well, they, unlike, let's say, the fascist, Mussolini and a lot of other ones who were really fighting communism, Bolshevism, for them it was personified in an ethnic group that had to be cleansed. So, yeah, and that's why the far right in Ukraine is still relevant, because they're fighting actual Russians, and communism is just sort of like a disease that the Russian carrier carries, or that the Jewish carrier carries, but you still target the same people. Yeah. And that's
and they underwent a particularly horrible version of Stalinism, and it isn't insane to associate that with Russian people, but it's not very smart either.
No, but it's useful for us. I mean, it's been. I just keep wondering when Ukrainian nationalists will think, whoa, wait a minute. We've been used all this time. I mean.
Yeah, when the 1945 epiphany will come.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these stories. So after the war, not only we take in people like Mykola Lebed and some of these other fascists, but we also. A lot of these guys were very geared up to do fighting, and we thought, some of our CIA hotheads thought, yeah, let's send these guys, let's send these Ukrainian nationalists back in behind the lines. We'll show Stalin that we can still do something. You know, he needs to know that we're doing something. You know, Americans are really into doing something. You got to do something. So we parachuted in I don't know how many hundreds, one after another, for a period of about 4 or 5 years. This program led by Frank Wisner, I believe. The CIA would parachute in all of these Ukrainian nationals. We train them up in Germany, fly in these, you know, unmarked planes, drop them in. Because the OUN, after the war, was still fighting the Soviets. It was a brutal, brutal insurgency, counterinsurgency from 45 through 51 or so. We waited until they were pretty close to being defeated before we came up with a lot of the funds and the airdrops. And we dropped them in, and literally every single one of them was captured. And most of them were captured and then used to spread disinformation back to their contacts in the West about, you know, as the book said, yes, send more money and more men. So they got more men in, immediately captured. And this went on and on and on. All of them were executed.
I mean, one of the great paradoxes of that whole Cold War thinking in the U.S., in the West, let's say, if you can call it thinking, is that it should have been pretty obvious that if there's one thing Marxist-Leninist regimes are good at, it's espionage, counterintelligence, and counterinsurgency. They weren't very good at a lot of things, but they were good at that. And that should have been really obvious.
Because they're conspiratorial and underground, and they had a lot of experience in underground.
Yeah.
And then you know, reversing that and making sure there was no other underground around. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it inspired, frankly, a lot of envy in people who were insane to envy anyone who'd had to live a life like that. But then you get that kind of craziness. You get a bunch of Hollywood stars and producers making a film like Rambo 2, where Sylvester Stallone pretends to be a muscle-bound Viet Cong, because they all had this envy of the Viet Cong because they had no idea what it's like to live out in that parasite-infested heat for any length of time at all. But they thought it had a certain romance. And when you talk about that frat boy macho stuff, I think there was a lot of that throughout the Cold War. Like, much as we hate these commies, they're kind of cool. They're really conspiratorial, and they're spies, and they assassinate people.
Yep, and I think that's why a lot of these guys, and they still come from a similar class, still like to have the Russians as an enemy. I mean, they're a good frat house to have a rivalry with, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they'll help you fund the F-35.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They're also good for business. That's definitely true.
Yeah.
So
I think we've settled some hash tonight. I know.
I think there's World War II is a bummer. You know, I don't know why everyone seems to love it so much.
I don't know. Them black and white movies or something. I don't know.
So before we sign off, I just want to read maybe a reader letter or two. We got some really good letters after the last show. I just want to read one or two off, and then we'll sign.
Yeah, yeah.
So this one is from Richard. I'll just say Richard. I'm not sure if they wanted us to use their names yet. So it's from subscriber Richard. And he says here, just to clear up Mark Ames' point about Korea's empire, he has the 16th century date mixed up with the actual 6th century date. And that happens with me sometimes, you know.
That happens.
Yeah. Quick aside. Two quick asides. One is Garry Kasparov, you know, the chess champion, opposition leader. He's developed this whole mathematical theory that we've been lied to, and that it's only been 1,000 years since Christ was killed, not 2,000, and that it's all a, it's a conspiracy. I swear to God, he's got it all. It's like a whole movement in Russia. That's the first one. The other one is, I forgot to bring this up when you were talking about El Salvador. There was this restaurant in Moscow called Navarro's. It was this really good kind of Nouvelle Mexican cuisine, I'd say Nouvelle Latin American cuisine. And the chef and the owner of the restaurant was this guy, Yuri Navarro, who was El Salvadoran, and who, when he was a young kid, fought in the FMLN.
Wow.
And he told us a few stories once, and the one I remember, he was a great guy, amazing cook, by the way. I think he went to the CIA, the Culinary Institute for the Arts, you know, the big chef school.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, got out alive from all that. But he told us this one story, I remember, where he and some others from the FMLN were ordered to take over a radio station and a transmitter tower. And so they did, and they took over the radio, and they tied up the people who had, you know, the government people who were running it. They tied them up, but didn't harm them. And then spent the night and the next day, like, sending out all these propaganda, you know, pro-FMLN, anti-junta messages, and I think had tape recorders going on and so on, but they didn't, and then they left, and then hurt them and tried to kind of win them over. And he was kind of, he'd laugh when he'd tell these stories, you know. And I said, you know, the other side was so brutal, though. I mean, that's kind of how they won. I'm trying to remember the UN report, it was something like 93% of all the killings were done by the government, or more, 95%.
Yes, yes.
And, of the 75,000 who died, right? And he said, but we, you know, whatever we wanted to do, we had to do it that way, because our only strength, as much as we had any, was support from the peasants. And we couldn't be, we could not be brutal and have their support. Which is really interesting, because Americans were convinced, and they got this idea from Nazi counterinsurgency theory, which they trusted a lot because it was also anti-communist base in the early Cold War years, that communists' partisans could only possibly have the support of local populations because of terror, and that therefore our forces had to do counter-terror measures, which was also, in other words, terror, in order to make them fear you more than they feared the communists. And that was doctrinal, you know. And again, like, go back to Landau, like, in his private memoir, he would kind of, in diaries, which were released after his death, he would admit, the hook, those people had genuine grievances, but he would never talk about it publicly, and it wasn't acted on. And that's why he advanced in his career. It's why Kennedy loved him. It's why, you know, kept moving up, and reporters, you know, slobbered at his feet. Because he stuck to the program, which was communists only control areas because they terrorize populations, which is definitely true in some areas, but it's far from telling the whole story.
Yeah, well, it doesn't sound like, I mean, if they left all those people alive, then it wasn't very true in El Salvador. The first idea that would have occurred to someone from one of D'Aubuisson's squads was, well, of course we kill everybody at the radio station. The question is, how do we kill them in a way that will stick in these people's memories?
Exactly. How do we mutilate them is the only question. Yeah.
That will get them waking up screaming 10 years from now.
Yeah. Okay, getting back to Richard's letters. I got a little sidetrack there. You got the 16th century date mixed up with the 6th century date, which is when there was a state called Goguryeo, with its capital in Pyongyang and borders stretching out to Liaodong and Manchurian heartlands. Regardless of the error, he's definitely right about the wounded nationalism and memories of Koguryo's greatness runs very strong, even in modern-day South Koreans, and is a point of contention with China, which has tried to subsume the histories of all peoples who ever lived in her modern-day borders. This was evidenced most famously back in the Knots in their Northeastern project of the Chinese Academy, which led to a controversy about whose people owned Koguryo. In any case, I think the wounded nationalism-influenced worldview that the war nerd makes is a very good point, which I've often found people living in a still dominant country like the U.S. having a hard time comprehending. In Korea's case, a lot of the chauvinism stems from the fact that despite its long history, during which the Koreans felt quite proud of their history, once the industrial age rolled around, the country hardly registered a blip in the minds of Westerners. Westerners simply saw East Asia as being inhabited by China, always an important trading partner, then Japan, became much more familiar with its successful westernization, and that other country in between, which didn't matter. What's even more grating for the Koreans is that since East Asia is rooted in the Sino-cultural sphere, once someone sees China and Japan, when they come around to Korea, it's basically, quote, been there, seen that, unquote. This leads to an intense obsession with Korean nationalists trying to overcompensate by claiming that such and such cultural aspects are uniquely Korean and most definitely not Japanese nor Chinese, which leads to controversies like Taekwondo is completely Korean and not at all influenced by Japanese martial arts, or Korean language is the most elegant language system in the world. God, this sounds so European, too. This is also why even the name Sea of Japan makes many Koreans angry, just like the Warner's comment about Persian Arabian Gulf a few podcasts ago, calling it Sea of Japan seems to Koreans another point for making Japan seem more unique and deserving attention at the cost of Koreans' pride.
I have to make a point about this. I mean, if I don't understand anything else, I understand poetry. And look, where are you standing if you call a place the Sea of Japan? Where are you calling? Mm-hmm. Where are you standing if you call a place, for example, the Irish Sea? You're standing in England, looking out toward the alien island. It's the conquerors who get the privilege of naming things. So that, yeah, not only is this kind of argument bizarre manifestation of nationalism, I would say that it is rhetorically mistaken as well.
Right. He ends the letter. I think with Korea's increasing prosperity and global recognition through companies like Samsung or Hyundai, Koreans will slowly grow out of their self-esteem issues, but it's definitely not going away anytime soon. I actually doubt they'll grow out of the self-esteem issues. I mean, they'll be... that can just last a long time.
We grew up in this supposedly dominant nation, and it has self-esteem issues to spare.
Make America great again.
But that's a great letter.
It is a great letter. Yes, thank you, Richard, for that. That's a great letter, great insight. And hell, maybe we should have him on one time to talk about Korea, its empire. I just remember seeing there was a... Koreans make great war movies. They make a lot of great movies lately. But there was one war movie. Maybe it was from that period. Maybe I got them mixed up. Huge sets, tons of people, you know, like these giant kind of pre-industrial age battles. And I thought it was, for some reason, I thought it was from the 16th century. But what do I know? Okay, I think it's enough for now.
All right.
We're about 2.5 hours in. So, is that it, I guess? You know, John, you have any last words before we send you back to the Phnom Penh?
Yeah, let's see what happens with this truce with FARC in Colombia. That's a very interesting development. Mm-hmm. I mean, Brexit, probably nothing will actually happen anytime soon. But FARC is one of the biggest, most powerful, enduring guerrilla armies in the world. If they've really agreed to end the war, that would be pretty important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If there's a world left a week from now due to Brexit, right? I mean, there's even a world there. All right, so that should end the show, and that's another thing we should probably do a show on. And I remember the Warner, you wrote a great piece on FARC and that whole war, 100 years of slaughtertude or something. I'm trying to remember what it was called. But an old Warner.
Persona, folks. It's a persona.
But that would also be a good subject for an upcoming show.
Absolutely. Yeah, we should, actually. And maybe we can get someone to help us with it.
Yeah, that would be great. Okay. Good luck out there.
Okay.
Stay healthy and talk to you next week.
Okay. Bye, Mark.
Bye.
nuestro merece la victoria. No le fallaremos.